way government regains the trust of its citizens is by telling the truth. There is no other way, no shortcut.
And I call upon our government to open up like the Belgians have, the French have, the Brazilians have, the Argentines, the Mexicans have all released their files. It's about time now that we do the same thing and become a part of this planetary community.
It is way past time for all of us to know what our own government knows, instead of being kept in the dark by a policy of denial.
The last time that Congress held a hearing addressing the extraterrestrial issue was 1968, 44 years of sightings ago. In those 4.5 decades, hundreds of thousands of new sightings have taken place. Government agency witnesses have come forward. Media coverage has expanded. Hundreds of documentaries have been produced. Thousands of books have been written. And yet the United States Congress has remained silent. So for a period of 5 days, at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., 2 blocks from the White House, and 12 blocks from the Congress of the United States, we're going to conduct a citizen hearing on disclosure of an extraterrestrial presence engaging the human race. 40 to 50 witnesses of high rank and station, from military, from agencies, and possibly from intelligence services, along with the top researchers in the world, will give 30 hours of testimony to 5 former members of the United States Congress.
So maybe the citizens' hearing has a chance to try to leverage open some of the truth about the fact that we're not alone in this universe, that we might actually begin to look at what we really are, what the true history of this planet is, and that might be what gets us into a future without self-destruction.
The model of the citizen hearing is if Congress won't do its job, the people will.
Greetings, everybody. Welcome to Galactic Roundtable, the countdown to disclosure. I'm so happy to be here with you again today. It's very nice to see everything unfolding so sweetly. Yesterday, we were reviewing old history because back on May 9th, 2001, Dr. Stephen Greer did a presentation at the National Press Club, and many military personnel, witnesses, came forward and spoke about what they knew about the extraterrestrial presence engaging with our government. And at the citizens' hearing on disclosure, we won't see much of that. We won't see the military presence there so much, not these kind of witnesses. So we know that 4 months after this May 9th, 2001 presentation, then we had 9/11, and that postponed a lot of things for over 11 years. So we're giving a nod to history these 2 days, and we're reflecting on this testimony that came before. So we're going to pick up right where we were yesterday, where we left off. Enjoy this, everybody. It's really great stuff.
My name is John Maynard. I'm retired Army. I retired as a Sergeant First Class. For my entire year, 21 years of service, I held a top secret clearance. Compartmentalized at times, to as high as TK, Omni, Crypto, and others. I had access to very, very sensitive documents. My testimony is basically two-pronged. One, I retired from DIA in 1980. And when as an administrator you take over an office, you take over everything and you sign for everything. And I signed for well over 2,000 documents. In order to sign an inventory of those things, you have to read them. Not word for word, but basically I went through every document to make sure that it was complete. It was there, as they told me, that when I turned my charge over to the next person, those same documents were there. So I got quite a good knowledge of what was going on in those documents, and believe me, There are many, many different references to UFOs. There was also NPIC pictures. It shows that it would targeted objects that were casing around. Now, I worked on the SALT 1 and SALT 2 areas for the office that I worked in. So we were taking pictures all the time for verification of nuclear disarmament. And there were some objects in those pictures that didn't belong there. The second prong to this whole thing is that a lot of people talk about conspiracies over a shadow government. I'm willing to testify before Congress that these black operations do exist. I nearly became part of it. But I saw the light, I think. Or was it? And I got out. And that's it. We have to disclose what we know. And I am willing to testify before Congress under oath. Or before any other organization. That what I witnessed was true.
Good morning. My name is Carl Wolf, and I was a precision electronics photographic repairman with a top secret crypto clearance in the United States Air Force. I was stationed at Langley Air Force Base in Virginia. In 1965, I was loaned to the Lunar Orbiter Project at NASA on Langley Field. Dr. Colley was in charge of that project. They had problems with a piece of electronic equipment that was bottlenecking their production of photographs. I went to the facility, and when I walked into the facility, there were scientists from all over the world. I was stunned, actually, to see people at a NASA project from all over the world. It didn't make any sense to me initially. I was taken into the laboratory where the equipment was malfunctioning. I couldn't repair it in the dark. I asked to have it removed. Airman Second Class was in the dark room at that time. I was also an Airman Second Class. I was interested in how the whole process functioned, how the data got from the lunar orbiter to the laboratory. I asked the young man if he'd describe the process to me. He did. About 30 minutes into the process, he said to me, in a very distressed way, by the way, we've discovered a base on the backside of the moon. And then he proceeded to put photographs down in front of me, and clearly in these photographs were structures, mushroom-shaped buildings, spherical buildings, and towers. And at that point, I was very concerned because I knew we were working on compartmentalized security. He had breached security, and I was actually frightened at that moment, and I did not question him any further. And a few moments later, someone did come into the room. I worked there for 3 more days, and I remember going home and naively thinking, I can't wait to hear about this on the evening news. And here it is, more than 30 years later, and I hope we hear about it tonight. And I will testify under oath before Congress that what I'm saying is the truth.
I just want to jump in here a second and say, remember with Carl Wolf's testimony that they had found structures on the moon. It was 1965, and NASA had these pictures, and they didn't land on the moon until 1969. It was the NSA astronauts that were on the moon in 1961. That's why there were people from all over the world to look at the photos of the towers on the moon.
Thank you, Carl. Good morning, everyone. My name is Donna Hare, and I worked at Philco Ford Aerospace from 1967 to 1981. During that time, I was a design illustrator, draftsman. I did the launch slides and landing slides, and also projection plotting boards, lunar maps for NASA. We were a contractor, but most of the time I worked on site. In Building 8. I had the opportunity to do extra work during downtime, which was between missions, and I walked into
a photo lab, which was the NASA lab across the hallway. I had a secret clearance, which is not that high, but I was able to go into restricted areas, which this was. At the time, I was talking to one of the techs in there, and he drew my attention to a photograph, that a NASA photograph. It had a dot on it, and I said, "What is that?" Well, he drew my attention to it, and I said, "Is that a dot on the emulsion?" And he said, and he's smiling, and he has his hands crossed, and he said, "Round dots on the emulsion don't leave round shadows on the ground." And this was an aerial photograph of the Earth, I'm assuming the Earth, because it had pine trees on it. And the shadows of the craft or whatever it was were in the same angle as the trees. And by its very nature, UFO, and I wanted to clarify that to a gentleman that was talking to me, means unidentified. So I did not know what this was. But I realized at this point that it's very secret, that it was kept secret, because I asked him, "What are you going to do with this piece of information?" And he said, "We always airbrush these out before we sell them to the public." So they're pesky little creatures appearing on this photograph they wanted to get rid of. After that, I decided I would ask questions to other people that work there. And I found that I had to ask them away from the site and not on site. A guard told me that he was asked to burn some photographs and not to look at them. And there was a guard, another guard guarding him, who was in green fatigues, watching him burn the photographs. And he said he was too tempted. He looked at one, and it was a picture of a UFO. And he was very descriptive. I can go into that later with anyone. He immediately was hit in the head, and he had a big gash in his forehead. He was knocked out, and he's terrified. So he would have to be protected. Another incident, I knew someone in quarantine with the Apollo astronauts. He told me that the Apollo astronauts saw craft on the moon when we landed. And that is what he told me. And he also was afraid. He said that the astronauts are told to keep this quiet. They're not allowed to talk about it. So I do want to let you know that I worked out there for a number of years, and this, I ran into this. So it's not something everyone knows that works out there for a long time. My boss didn't know about it. Some people that sat right next to me didn't know about it. It's very strange, because I don't know how they can do it, but they can let some people know about it and then others not. I'm willing to testify before Congress that what I'm saying is true, and thank you very much.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and members of the press. My name is Larry Warren. 20 years ago, in 1980, I was a security specialist assigned to RAF Bentwaters, Woodbridge, NATO Air Force facilities in Suffolk, East Anglia. I had a secret security clearance. I guarded our backline nuclear weapons that were stored there at the time, without the knowledge of the people of Great Britain. I went through a portion of a three-night UFO event where objects made incursions over our WSA, fired pencil-thin beams of light into them, and adversely affected the ordnance, possibly. These objects were on the ground on two different nights. Potentially, there was another life form seen. This is an unpopular truth. These events were of extreme defense significance to not only Her Majesty's government, but this government as well, and they are still shrouded in secrecy. They are very complex. They are very vast. This is more about a human rights issue than just a UFO issue. 20 years ago, this room would be empty. I see a turn in history. This is history in motion, but unfortunately, it's history with the security classification. I would be more than honored to swear under oath that I experienced what I did. I saw what I saw. These events produced not only after numerous denials by this government, a memo by Lieutenant Colonel Charles Holt, our deputy base commander, which reads like science fiction. It also produced years later an on-site audio tape he made as these objects performed their feats and did what they did and violated airspace. These events are of extreme defense significance. I hope my brothers in arms that went through these events will be given immunity at some point and be able to join us here. It is an honor to share the stage with all of these people. And I think for all of our children, my son Dennis, God bless you, son, we can change the world. You're heroes for being here also, and I will testify in front of Congress if asked to. God bless. Thank you.
Hi, my name is George Filer III. The reason I'm here is because George Filer V is in the hangar and will be born on Friday. And I'm a retired intelligence officer and flyer with almost 5,000 hours, and I didn't believe in UFOs until London Control called us in the winter of 1962 and asked us, would we chase one? And we said, sure. So we let down from 30,000 feet to 1,000 feet where the UFO was hovering, and we went into a steep dive and actually exceeded the red line of the aircraft. So it's kind of dangerous chasing UFOs. Any case, I was able to get the UFO on the aircraft radar at about 40 miles, and we could see a light out in the distance. And as we closed, we kept on picking up this radar return. Point I'm mentioning that the radar return was very distinct and solid, indicating it was some kind of a metallic object. We got about a mile from the UFO, and it kind of lit up in the sky and went off into space, very similar to what the shuttle looks like when it takes off. Later on, I was working in intelligence in Vietnam. I briefed General Brown about UFOs when I was in 21st Air Force, McGuire Air Force Base. Briefed General Glau about a UFO over Tehran, Iran in 1976. The two F-4s from the Iranian Air Force had taken off and tried to intercept the UFO. And when they turned on their fire control systems, they immediately went out. All the electrical systems went out. The planes had to return to base. This was particularly significant because it was also picked up on satellites. In 1978, on January 18th, I was going into the base. Every morning I did the briefing to the general staff, and I noticed that there are some lights off in the distance at the end of the runway there. And when I got into the command post, the senior master sergeant in charge said that there had been UFOs in the pattern all night. They're on radar. The tower had seen them. They got in aircraft reports and so on. And that one had landed or crashed at Fort Dix. Fort Dix and McGuire are right together. And this is kind of like the Roswell of the East. But in any case, an alien had come off the craft and had been shot by a military policeman and apparently was wounded and was heading for McGuire. So for whatever reason, the aliens liked the Air Force better than the Army, perhaps because they're shooting at them. But in any case, our security police went out there and found him on the end of the runway dead. And they asked me to brief the general staff, General Tom Sadler, and at the 8 o'clock stand-up briefing. And I said, I don't think I want to do this. You know, the general doesn't have a good sense of humor, and I'm not sure I believe this. So I did some checking, called the 438th command post, and everybody had pretty much the same story. And at 8 o'clock that morning, just before I went on, was going to brief this, and I was very worried about it. They said, don't brief it, that it's too hot, so to speak. That's pretty much my story, and I'm prepared to tell the story in front of Congress, and it is a truth. Now, because of this, I've stayed interested in UFOs, and I'm the Eastern Director of the Mutual UFO Network, and between the National Reporting Center and Peter Davenport and the MUFON, we get 100 reports a week on average of people from all over the United States that see these things regularly. And if you start checking, they're out there and they're low and people are seeing them all the time. And these are highly qualified people, all of whom essentially give us the reports by email. Thank you.
Morning, ladies and gentlemen.
My name's Clifford Stone. I was Sergeant First Class, United States Army. I had a secret clearance with Nuclear Assurity. I could get the clearance that I needed to do whatever it was that was necessary for me to do at the time on special operations when I was called in on those. What I'm referring to here is that I was involved in situations where we actually did recoveries of crashed saucers, for lack of a better term, debris thereof. There were bodies that were involved with some of these crashes, also some were alive. While we were doing all this, we were telling the American public there was nothing to it. We were telling the world there was nothing to it. I'd like to go into detail on some of the cases about the nuts and bolts cases right here, but I will be available if you have any questions concerning my involvement in this. You can talk to Dr. Greer to arrange for me to get to talk to you. But the whole situation is we've stepped back. We've told the American people that there's no such thing as UFOs. I've been involved where we have recovered these objects. We know them to be of extraterrestrials. In 1969, I had an event that happened to me while I was stationed at Fort Lee, Virginia. We went to Indiantown Gap, Pennsylvania. That would be my first exposure to any time that we would be recovering an unidentified flying object. When we went there, we already had people that was already in the facility. We were a backup team, which was supposed to be NBC because there was supposed to be some nuclear materials that was on board this craft. Later on, most people involved were to be told that there was nothing on board it. It was nothing more than just a crash of one of our aircraft. I know better because I was one of the people that approached it with a Geiger counter to get surface readings. I was the first person to go ahead and see that there were bodies on it. That would be the first of approximately 12 events. UFO crashes are not events that take place every day. They're rare. I know we're not alone in the universe. I know that the absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. It's evidence that has been denied to the American people. I stand before you today in my almighty God, and I tell you this. If Congress calls me in and says, will you testify in detail what you know, I stand here today prepared and ready to do just that. Governments must never lie to the people for no reason. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Mark McCandlish, and for the last 21 years, I have worked as a conceptual artist for a variety of defense contractors. I've been involved in conceptual artwork or the production thereof for Rockwell on the X-30 program and also on the HISTEP program. That's spelled H-Y-S-T-P, means hypersonic testbed program. During the course of my career, I've twice had a secret security clearance. In 1967, while my father was stationed at Westover Air Force Base, the headquarters for 8th Air Force Strategic Air Command, I witnessed and watched through a telescope a UFO which hovered over a nuclear weapons storage facility for approximately 10 minutes and then departed with an acceleration approaching a bullet leaving a rifle barrel. In 1988, in November, a college buddy of mine, an associate by the name of Brad Sorensen, informed me that he had personally witnessed three flying saucers at a very large hangar at Norton Air Force Base during the course of an air show that was held on Saturday, November 12, 1988. I subsequently called my congressman from that district. I called his office. This was Congressman George E. Brown, Jr., who at the time was the chairman of the Congressional Committee on Space Science and Advanced Technology. I naturally assumed that since this presentation that Brad talked about was for top military brass and certain congressional individuals, that his office must have coordinated this with the local Air Force Office of Public Affairs. A male staff member in Congressman Brown's office not only confirmed the exhibit, but the fact that there were three discs at that exhibit. These discs were hovering off the floor without any visible means of support. They were referred to as alien reproduction vehicles, also nicknamed the Flux Liner because they used high voltage electricity. to keep things short, this is a diagram that I made based on a sketch that Brad Sorensen did for me in rough form shortly after he had his sighting, and subsequently cleaned that drawing up and made it much more accurate. And that's the drawing that Dr. Greer is holding there now. Later on, I obtained photographs that were taken in 1967 by a military pilot, Harvey Williams, flying a C-47 for the Air Force at 12,000 feet, approximately 25 miles southwest of Provo, Utah. This particular vehicle matches the so-called ARV in all proportions and respects in terms of the detail of the shape of the craft. And this was photographed, as I say, in June or July of June of 1967. I later spoke to a gentleman by the name of Kent Sellen that I met at an air show at Edwards Air Force Base in 1992, the first unveiling publicly of the B-2 bomber. He indicated to me that in 1973, when he was a crew chief working on experimental aircraft at Edwards Air Force Base, that he had unintentionally wandered into an area where there was a classified aircraft, namely the ARV. He described it in detail, and he added other details to the account concerning the configuration and the operation of the vehicle that Brad Sorensen was not aware of. Subsequently, Brad Sorensen met with the famous aeronautical designer Burt Rutan, gave him a copy of this blueprint, which you've just been shown. Mr. Rutan felt that it was a joke and put it on his wall as kind of a joke. And a third party confirmed for me later that a Colonel Ray Walsh from Edwards Air Force Base was visiting Mr. Rutan, saw this this blueprint on the wall and registered quite a degree of shock and anger, wanted to know where the hell he got this blueprint, because there was, in fact, such a craft at that time, approximately 1994-95, in a hangar at Edwards Air Force Base, North Base Complex at that time. Subsequently, I've done a lot of research on this product, this vehicle. I've come across a number of declassified documents that show that the Air Force, as early as 1960, was wind tunnel testing flying saucer shapes up to Mach 20. And I also have declassified NASA documents that show similar shapes. In fact, this is the document here that more or less details the wind tunnel testing up to Mach 20. This is the NASA document right here that was declassified, and it shows a variety of spherical and lenticular shapes that were flight tested up to, or I should say wind tunnel tested up to Mach 6. I subsequently obtained a copy of an interoffice memo from Hercules Aerospace that describes a particular type of science involving something called zero-point energy and scalar waves. According to Brad Sorensen, this is the basis of the technology for these anti-gravity propulsion systems. This particular document here describes six different meetings involving the Defense Intelligence Agency and cooperative efforts with the Russian scientific community in investigating this what is called the fundamental enabling technology that was originally discovered apparently by Nikola Tesla in the early 1900s. Anyway, I could provide you much more detail in a later time, and I am prepared to testify in detail concerning these events and their truthfulness before Congress. Thank you very much.
My name is Daniel Sheehan. I'm an attorney and serving as general counsel to the Disclosure Project. I'm a 1967 graduate of Harvard College in American Government Studies and Constitutional Law, and a graduate of Harvard Law School. And I served as general counsel and one of the co-counsel for the New York Times in the Pentagon Papers case, and was involved in briefing and arguing the case in front of the United States Supreme Court, giving permission to the New York Times to publish the classified documents, the 47 volumes of the Pentagon Papers. Subsequent to that time, I served as special counsel to the office of F. Lee Bailey as one of the trial counsels when we represented James McCord in the Watergate burglary and got Mr. McCord to write the letter to Judge Sirica to reveal the Watergate burglar's relationship to the plumber's unit in the White House at that time. Subsequent to my service in that case, I went back to Harvard to the Divinity School to study Judeo-Christian social ethics and public policy, did my master's work and PhD work there, and became general counsel for the United States Jesuit headquarters in Washington, D.C., assigned to the National Social Ministries Office and their public policy office. It was there in 1977 that I was contacted by Ms. Marcia Smith, who was the director of the Science and Technology Division of the Congressional Research Service. She asked to meet with me, and I met with her, and she informed me that President Carter, upon taking office in January of 1977, held a meeting with then the director of Central Intelligence, who was George Bush Sr., and demanded that the director of Central Intelligence turn over to the president the classified information about unidentified flying objects and the information that was in the possession of the United States intelligence community concerning the existence of extraterrestrial intelligence. This information was refused to the President of the United States by the Director of Central Intelligence, George Bush Sr. The director insisted that the President, in order to have access to this information, needed to have clearance to contact the Congressional Research Service, to contact the United States House of Representatives Science and Technology Division, to have them undertake a process to declassify this information, because the DCI suspected that the president was preparing to reveal this information to the American public. The Congressional Research Service Science and Technology Division, under the directorship of Marcia Smith, was contacted by the House Science and Technology Committee and instructed to undertake a major investigation of the existence of extraterrestrial intelligence and the relationship of the UFO phenomenon to this. I was contacted by Ms. Smith and asked, in my capacity as general counsel to United States Jesuit Headquarters, National Social Ministry Office, to see if we could obtain access to the Vatican Library to obtain the information that the Vatican had with regard to extraterrestrial intelligence and the phenomenon of the UFOs. I pursued that with the permission of Father William J. Davis, the director of the National Office, and we were refused access, as the United States Jesuit order, to the information in the possession of the Vatican Library. When I reported this to Ms. Smith, she then later subsequently asked me to participate in a project, which I can go into some detail during the question and answer period or later to individuals, pursuant to which I was given access to, as a special consultant to the United States Library of Congress Congressional Research Service, to the classified portions of the Blue Book project of the Air Force. At that point, it was in 1977, approximately May of 1977, I went to the Madison building of the United States Library of Congress. There was no one in the building at that time. It was brand new. I was directed to a basement office where there were two guards at the door and a third sitting at the table who took my identification, verified that I'd been designated as a special consultant to the Congressional Research Service of the United States Library of Congress, and was admitted to the room. I thereupon found photographs, some dozen photographs, of what is unquestionably an unidentified flying object on the ground that had crashed and plowed a furrow in a field of snow, and it was embedded in a bank, an embankment. There were United States Air Force personnel surrounding this craft, taking photographs of the craft, and one of the photographs, I could see that there were some symbols on the side of the craft. So I proceeded through the photographs and found a close-up photograph of these symbols I've been instructed that I was to take no notes and had to leave my briefcase and all my identification outside of this room, but I had brought with me a yellow pad. And so what I did is I opened up the yellow pad and refocused the overhead camera onto the same size as the cardboard backing of the yellow pad, and I physically traced the copies of the symbols on the side of this craft, closed the yellow pad back, put the microfiche back into the canister, reclosed the box that I had, and I said, it is time for me to leave. And I took this and proceeded to leave the office, at which point the security guard stopped me, and one of them said, what is that you have there, Mr. Sheehan? At which point I handed the yellow pad to him, and he flipped through all the yellow pages and never found the copy that I had. And so I took that with me and brought it to the United States Jesuit headquarters, had a meeting with the staff, with Father William J. Davis, reported this to them, was authorized at that time by the United States Jesuit headquarters to make a report to the National Council of Churches and to request that the entire 54 major religious denominations of our country undertake a major study of extraterrestrial intelligence, which they declined to do. I was subsequently asked to deliver a three-hour closed-door seminar to the top 50 scientists of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory of SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, which I did do in 1977. I'm more than happy to testify under oath to these details to the United States Congress, and would be happy to meet with any members of the press at that time. You may recall I also served as chief counsel to the Karen Silkwood case, in which we obtained the rulings in the Karen Silkwood case. I also served as chief counsel in the Iran-Contra case. I was the first one to testify before the United States Congress to the existence of the off-the-shelf enterprise of Richard Secord and Albert Hakim. I'll be more than happy to share the details of what I believe to be the relationship between this off-the-shelf enterprise and the secret government, which is concealing this information from the American public. And I am happy and proud to serve as general counsel to the Disclosure Project. Thank you very much.
Good morning. My name is Carol Rosin. In 1974, after being a sixth-grade school teacher, I was introduced to the late Dr. Wernher von Braun in the U.S., the father of rocketry. In my first meeting with him during that first 3.5 hours, he said to me, Carol, you will stop the weaponization of space. And I said, teachers don't stop until June. He said, no, you have to understand, this is February. And we have to prevent the weaponization of space because there is a lie being told to everyone that the weaponization of space is now first being based upon the evil empire, the Russians. There are many enemies, he said, against whom we're going to build this space-based weapon system, the first of whom was the Russians, which was existing at that time. Then there would be terrorists. Then there would be third world countries. Now we call them rogue nations or nations of concern. Then there would be asteroids. And then he would repeat to me over and over, and the last card, the last card, the last card would be the extraterrestrial threat. Well, at the time, I kind of laughed when he said asteroids, and when he said extraterrestrials, I knew I wasn't going to deal with that subject. And now we hear on the news just today, this week, that they've slid in another enemy. Only this time we're going to protect our satellites. In other words, we have to have some reason to spend these trillions, to waste these dollars on a space-based weapon system, and they're all lies. This is a system, he told me, that would never protect anyone. Even back then, he talked about suitcase bombs. He talked about chemical, viral, bacterial, biological warfare that these space-based weapons would never protect us against. And then he told me that, in fact, if you travel around the world, which I did after he died in 1977, I met with people in over 100 countries who were friends. They didn't want to build space-based weapons. I became a space and missile defense consultant, and I worked with people around the world. I became an advisor to the People's Republic of China. They don't want to build a space-based weapon system. And he told me back then that they didn't. He said, go to Russia. They're considered to be the enemy. I got on a plane by myself. When I got to Russia, I had a list of people that I had read out of the newspaper. Chernenko was in office then. He was the only one I didn't get a chance to meet. They introduced me to everyone when I got there. And when I got back, I said, oh, my Lord, this man is telling the truth. There is no threat. And I've been waiting until this day for 27 years, and I'm expecting the spin to happen, because he also explained to me that as a military strategist, as a person who worked on the MX missile, which I did later, he said, you will find that there is going to be a spin to find some enemy against whom we have to build space-based weapons. And now we should expect the spin, because he said part of the formula for the intelligence community is if they might have a weapon, then we have to consider that they do have these weapons. So now they do have these weapons. So now we have to build these weapon systems. And that's the formula, except that it's all based on a lie. And we have witnesses here today that have shown you that these extraterrestrial beings, that these craft that have come here are now not UFOs, they're identified flying objects. And we know that they have beings in them. And we have witnesses here who have told you that they can shut down our missile silos. They can stop a rocket going into space that's a test. We have witnesses here who have worked in the classified departments, who have the courage to come forward here to support what Wernher von Braun told me back in 1974 to 77. And I will testify before the Congress that when I founded the Institute for Security and Cooperation in Outer Space, which I shut down a few years ago because I didn't believe we had a chance with this huge, integrated around the world, complex weapon system, that we had any chance at all of transforming that war industry into a space industry that could provide benefits, like Dr. Greer has said, of global warming. We can end that situation of that problem. We can end the energy crisis. We can build now non-polluting technologies. Wernher von Braun used to tell me that we could have cars back then that drove around off the ground. He described this to me on beams, so that we have no pollution on this planet. And we can solve the problems of the people that are urgent and potential, and the other animals and the other cultures on Earth and in space. And we can end the arms race without dislocating the industry jobs, without disrupting the economy, by transforming, Wernher von Braun told me, the war industry into a global cooperative space industry that will provide, he said, finally, more jobs and profits on this planet than during any hot or cold wartime, more products and services that can be applied directly to solving the problems of this planet. And we can have a whole planet now that lives in peace on Earth, with all the cultures on Earth and with all the extraterrestrial cultures in space. And these are words that Wernher von Braun told me in 1974. And I will testify before the Congress under oath about everything I have said and more. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank each of the witnesses and for your patience. We're running about 50 minutes late, and I do apologize for that. I want to emphasize that all of these witnesses each could speak for probably anywhere from 2 to 5 hours about what they have witnessed. We're trying to give you a snapshot. We have another 400 of these witnesses. I have carried this burden for 8 years. I'm now giving it to you, the American people and the people of the world, to take it forward. What I'd like to do now is open the audience for questions from the media. You may address them to me or to an individual witness as you deem appropriate. Yes, ma'am.
Yes, Maribel Gonzalez with Reforma, Mexican newspaper. I have 3 questions. One is, I wanted to know if there are laws in this country that in some way allowed this kind of secrecy or not. And then I wanted to know if there's a need to change any kind of law. And the next one I wanted to ask you, if you may, is who is profiting from this secrecy that maintains in secret the solution to the energy crisis. I mean,
well, let me get to those, okay, quickly, because we are short on time. First of all, I think initially there was an appropriate national security apparatus in place in the 40s during the Truman and also Eisenhower years. By the late Eisenhower years, we have a testimony from Brigadier General Stephen Lufkin, still a practicing attorney, that by the late Eisenhower years that he had lost control of these projects primarily because of the compartmentalization into the military-industrial complex, operative word industrial. There are corporations such as SAIC, Lockheed Martin, Northrop, and others that deal specifically with this issue, with advanced energy and propulsion systems connected to UFOs. And I think that what has happened, from the best we can tell, from insiders that have briefed me for now about 8 years, is that we have lost control of these projects from a constitutional law perspective because the infrastructure within military intelligence and corporate channels is so well funded and so complex and labyrinthine that there are compartments within compartments within compartments, and people who are in the Congress who make inquiries, and in fact President Clinton, when he made inquiries, were simply denied access, as you heard earlier that President Carter was denied access. On your other question, I would say that in terms of profiting from the status quo, big oil, there are certain geopolitical and financial infrastructures that would not welcome a definitive replacement to the fossil fuels. I will tell you, and we can prove this with other scientists who are ready to come forward, that we already have a complete replacement for any fossil fuels or ionizing nuclear power plants. We don't need them. We haven't needed them. Probably have not needed them since the time I was born. Now, of course, this is a major issue. You're talking a multi-trillion-dollar global infrastructure change. And so this does hit the alarm bells at the National Security Council economics area. However, what is more serious to the national security, keeping the status quo or letting ourselves go into a global ecosystem collapse and running out of fossil fuels and having massive rolling blackouts, not just in California, but globally? We have got to do something about this, and soon, and that's why we are advocating open hearings in the Congress. Other media, please. Yes, sir.
I just want to know if anybody at the UN is looking into this.
I personally met with Boutros Ghali's wife, Aliyah Ghali, who said that her husband was quite concerned about this. This was in the 1990s. Since then, we know that there have been other people at the UN who have made inquiries. The problem is the UN has no mandate to deal with this. It needs to be given a mandate from its constituent member nations. And I think that the public and the member nations need to ask that the United Nations get involved with this. This is an international peace issue and an international security issue, and it should be taken up by the UN Security Council. And, of course, we are recommending that as well. Yes, sir.
So I think my question is to Clifford Stone. You said that you had seen aliens on a craft that had crashed. I wondered if you could describe what they looked like.
I could, but it would probably take a whole lot of time. The reason I state that, when I got out in 1989, we had cataloged 57 different species. You have individuals that look very much like you and myself that could walk among us, and you wouldn't even notice the difference, except for some of the things that they might be able to go ahead, even in a dark room, and touch an object and go ahead and identify what color that object might be. They would have a heightened sense of smell, sight, hearing. The situation is that you have various types of what we normally call grays. We didn't call them grays in the military, but you had at least three types of the grays. You had some that were much taller than we were. The unique thing that I'd like to point out for the most part is that the entities that we did catalog were, in fact, humanoid. Now, this created a situation where the scientific community was trying to figure out why that would be the case, because you would expect that if life evolved on other planets, that they would take on some type of other being, so to speak, not necessarily look humanoid or be bipedal such as we are. But apparently, we got quite a few of the species out there that are humanoid in appearance, And that creates a question that yet has to be answered by science.
Yes, and I'm, as I call on you, please state the news agency that you were with. Yes, ma'am.
Deanne Dennis with United Press International. Could you please address the vehicle that there was a drawing displayed of? Why would this vehicle be on display at an air show? What is the power source that you are asserting is going to be so very useful? And how can you determine this vehicle is not something that is being developed, you know, by a government agency?
In fact, I think that was the testimony. This is an alien reproduction vehicle, and just to be clear, this means that it is based on advanced anti-gravity and zero-point energy propulsion systems. Those are the propulsion systems. They are being manufactured by a consortium of companies that include Lockheed Martin, Northrop, SAIC, and other corporations. They do have super luminal capacity, in other words, faster than the speed of light capacity. I think Mr. McCandlish and other witnesses that he's identified could go into more of the technical physics of it. I'm just a country doctor from Virginia, I tell people. I mean, really. This is actually what is the reason it's called alien reproduction vehicle is that it's based on the study of extraterrestrial vehicles, but it is manufactured by human military intelligence, aerospace contracting arrangements. And this is very important. It means that we, Homo sapiens, have the ability to access this so-called zero-point field of energy, which is the ambient field of energy from which all matter and energy is fluxing, and can access that energy and generate all the power we need to run this planet without fossil fuels or pollution.
Do you have any direct evidence, though, that this, I mean, we're talking about the same government that so appropriately named a snooper program Carnivore. So just because it's named the alien reproduction vehicle, considering the history and the questions that have been existing for such a long time about flying saucers, I mean, do you know, is there any direct reason to believe that this is actually derived from technology? Any of the witnesses who can attest to that? And how would this, a propulsion system, a rocket engine doesn't necessarily translate into electricity. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, the first part of your question, I would say that the testimony of witnesses we have, some of whom are here, others that are not here, but they're in the briefing materials, is that they have studied, we have studied specifically extraterrestrial vehicles which have been retrieved. The breakthroughs in that research have led to applications that have led to the building of this and similar anti-gravity devices, and that, in fact, that this can be proven in open testimony before Congress, and that is exactly what we are calling for. We have the witnesses to establish this, and they also then also have the documents and the specific details of the propulsion systems. But this is not a jet internal combustion system at all. It is actually kicked in by a type of electric power source, and it then accesses this ambient zero-point energy field that is responsible for all matter and energy existing, and by special configurations and what have you, it causes a cancellation of mass inertia and an anti-gravity effect. And this is a complex technical discussion, which is probably beyond the scope of this conference, but we have materials in the briefing document that we can provide you with references to people who have studied the anti-gravity effect as far back as certainly the 1950s. We have one witness who said that his family was connected to the RAND Corporation, and that by the mid-1950s that more money had been spent on anti-gravity propulsion systems than the totality of the Manhattan Project. So, yes, we can establish those elements. Other questions?
Thank you. My name is Murray Felsher. I publish a newsletter downstairs here called the Washington Remote Sensing Letter that deals with reconnaissance and surveillance of the Earth from space. My question is this. Since 1972 with the launch of Landsat 1 and now with the launch of commercial space imagery, there are some archived, I would say, upwards of 35 million photographs of the Earth from space. Not one of them has shown a flying saucer. Are you suggesting that these have been airbrushed out?
We're suggesting that there is a system before the public gets hold of anything that's off of a government-connected satellite. There is a compartmented operation that does indeed sanitize them from this type of evidence, and I think the testimony of The gentleman who was with the Defense Intelligence Agency, Mr. Maynard, Ms. Hare, and others would substantiate that. We have other witnesses who have been involved in projects where such items have been sanitized out. It could also be that if you did a thorough search, you might find a few that slipped through. We obviously haven't had the research dollars to go through all the millions of images that are cataloged to look for them, but we do know there's been a very thorough sanitizing of this. And people should not be naive about the extent to which covert programs using billions of our tax dollars have been able to effectively hide this. This is one of the sort of myths of both the media and the public. It's sort of a Pollyanna myth that we live in a society where such things could not be done. In fact, they are done, and we can prove that they have been done.
Entire proceedings here, and I'm wondering how your screening process went. Can you tell us a little bit about your satisfaction level with that? Well, I'm very satisfied that these are genuinely good people who are speaking truthfully. Not of 400 people that I'm dealing with, not 20 times this number. Have I been told, yeah, I'm an emergency doctor, let me say something. People come into the emergency department with flank pain, writhing on a stretcher, what have they got? A kidney stone, right? Yeah, well, some of them go into the bathroom, prick their fingers, squeeze blood into the water, the urine sample, to show that they have blood in their urine so they can get a narcotic injection. Now, have I been scammed as an emergency doctor? Because, you know, I'm bright enough to kind of know when I'm being scammed. But have I occasionally? Yeah. Is it possible? It's possible. Is it likely? No. And here's what's more important. You don't not treat or accept the testimony or the history of every patient that comes in with flank pain and assume that they're lying just because you've been scammed once or twice. This field, you make a very good point, is filled with hoaxes and scams and what have you. It doesn't mean, however, that all of it is. And in fact, what we're saying after 8 years of research, we have found the documents, the top secret witnesses, the insiders willing to testify under oath before Congress that this is true. Now, here's another key point. Some of the people who are in this witness pool, Mr. Sheehan, myself, and a couple of other attorneys, are members of state licensed professions. And what that means is that if we are perpetrating a hoax, we will lose our license to practice medicine. We will lose our license to practice law. We will be perpetrating a hoax upon the public. So what I would say to you is that the group of people before you are very credible, and the others whom we have identified are. We are not the CIA. We have not been able to do a $50,000 background check on each person. I'll give you that caveat. But we have done very serious interviews and vetting. And by the way, these people have presented their DD-214s, their defense forms, other documentation that show the DD-214s and others that show that they were in the military at a certain place at a certain time. So we're very comfortable that, in fact, that the weight of the testimony will carry the day here and that this is real.
I had an insight, and it relates to your question. There have been tens of thousands of sightings and experiences from all over the world. Only one of them needs to be true. Because if only one is true, then the entire case of the non-real science falls apart.
A priori, all signed agreements and oaths that have flowed from such operations are null and void. What that means is, in any other in legal theory, is that if it's an illegal enterprise, the agreements that are entered into as a result of that illegal enterprise have no legal standing. So one of the things I would like to announce today is all of the men and women listening to this need to know they are free to speak. We are declaring all national security oaths on this subject null and void. They have flowed from illegal operations that has no standing constitutionally. My people, my mother's family, who fought in the American Revolution, were prisoner of war with the British. They all found this country, did not fight and die, but formed the United States, so that this kind of chicanery could go on. So these men are free to speak, and there can be no legal repercussions against them. We have legal counsel who will also support this theory, and we're taking this to other constitutional scholars. It is time for that game to end. It is time for a new era in the human state.
That wraps it up, everybody. The Serious Movie, which is a documentary based on the life's work of Dr. Stephen Greer, has its LA premiere on April 22nd. It is released in theaters after that. Go see it. A week later, we have the Citizens Hearing on Disclosure in Washington, D.C. at the National Press Club, 2 blocks away from the White House and 12 blocks away from the Capitol building. We will not endure the truth embargo any longer. Thank you for being here with me today, everybody. I look forward to seeing you tomorrow. Namaste.